Disclaimer. Judge Ron Rengel is providing this podcast and website for educational purposes only, as well as to give the public general information regarding topics related to the criminal justice system. The views, thoughts, and opinions of his guest speakers are the speaker's own and do not represent the views, thoughts, and opinions of Judge Rengel. All rise. You are now listening to Beyond the Gavel with Judge Ron Rengel, educating the public and expanding mindsets. Subscribe on our website, beyondthegavelpodcast.com, or your favorite podcast platform for more of the latest podcast episodes and updates.
Welcome to Beyond the Gavel with Judge Ron Rengel. I'm your host. Today in the studio, I'm excited to introduce to you Emil Huggins. Now, Emil has worked as an adult probation officer for over 36 years, which includes both state and federal corrections systems. He currently manages the Bexar County CSCD specialty courts, which includes the Misdemeanor Adult Drug Court, DWI Court, Veterans Treatment Courts, Mental Health Court, Reflejo Court, Felony Veterans Treatment Court, Esperanza Court, Felony Drug Court, Felony Reentry Court, and Felony Dual Diagnosis Court. Now, for most of his career in both the federal and the state court systems, Emil has worked to develop and monitor outpatient and residential substance abuse treatment programs. He has and continues to serve on several nonprofit boards that support substance abuse and behavioral health treatment programs. I feel very fortunate to have him on the show today. Welcome, Emil.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
I appreciate you being here. Now, a benefit of having you here is not only are you a probation officer, so you can talk to us about what it's like to be a probation officer and what happens in probation, but you're also, as I indicated, responsible for management of the specialty courts in Bexar County.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about Bexar County and the number of people on supervision, it's about 30,000 people at any one time.
Mm-hmm.
With the specialty courts, that only makes up about probably between 500 and 600 people. So it's a small percentage, but it's a population that has high needs and high risks. So that's traditionally, what you want to do is you want to put your monies and times and efforts into the resources that people that need them.
All right. So that brings up a lot of questions. So you mentioned 30,000 folks in Bexar County on supervision through probation. How many officers does it take to supervise that number of folks?
I know we have a staff, officers and support staff and counselors. It's close to 400.
Now we have 27 district courts, 10 of them do felony caseloads, which means each of them requires folks on supervision.
Correct.
There are 13 county court at law criminal courts. Is that right?
Correct.
And then are there other types of courts that probation is involved in supervising?
There's like 13 specialty courts in Bexar County, and I work with 8 of them. So Judge Glenn is a full-time, and he has by far the largest caseload in terms of cases. He's got stays around 250.
Mm-hmm.
All the other judges that work with specialty courts, they have full-time dockets like yourself that do the specialty courts, you know, as an added duty. And they don't get any extra money for this. They don't. And it's a lot of work. And it's very intensive. But the funny thing is when you talk to those judges, they say working in specialty courts is the best part of their job.
Absolutely. Yeah. I can definitely understand why they would say that. In fact, we're starting late today because we got done with our specialty court. And so I definitely understand that sentimentality. Let me ask you a couple of questions about what it's like to be a probation officer, just in case anybody out there is interested in that type of a career. What sort of education and training does one need to be a probation officer?
Well, typically with the degree they want you to have, it would be a criminal justice degree. It has to have some kind of tie-in, like sociology, psychology, counseling degrees, something like that. So it's changed over time what the model of what a perfect probation officer is. Like, for instance, when I started back in 1987, I remember there was a probation officer. He was an old retired police officer. This was back in the days when people could smoke in their office. Mm-hmm. You know, people smoked in the courthouse, walking around, those kind of days. And I remember when people would come in for the first time to report, he would put his wallet on the table with his badge showing, and he'd ask him, "Do you know what that means?" They go, "No, I don't know what that means." He goes, "That means I'm your daddy now. You're going to do what I say you to." That would not happen these days.
No,
where it shouldn't happen. And, but yet those were the days where that was what was held up, and to be as, you know, tough on people as you could. You were trying to catch people doing things.
Right.
And now it's so much different. I mean, we used to, how we got our funding was based solely on the number of cases we had. Now that's part of the formula, but also what has been taken into account is our revocation rate. Mm-hmm. The whole idea is not to revoke people. The whole idea is put people in a position to succeed. And that's a lot more complicated. It takes a lot more effort than just, you know, trying to catch people doing wrong. Right. You want to put them in a position to do right a lot of times.
And so the state actually hurts probation departments if they have a higher rate of revocation.
Oh, without question. They'll take monies away from you. In the state of Texas, Bexar County is the fourth largest CSCD. And our revocation rate is one of the things that we're always, always keeping in mind. For instance, the perception of probation is, you know, that sometimes some people think we don't care about people, that we're just trying to get them revoked, that kind of stuff. The reality is nothing could be further than the truth.
Well, we're talking about funding and how the state allocates its funding. How specifically is probation funded?
No one really understands that, but actually we're not county employees and we're not state employees. We're kind of entities under ourselves. There's 156, I think, probation offices, entities in state of Texas. We get monies from the county to pay for our buildings, infrastructure, that those kind of things. We get monies from CJAD, the state, and they give certain monies based on different programs. There's DP funding, which is diversion funding for special programs. And then there's monies that we get from supervisory fees. So it comes from a lot of different places. Not every CSCD gets money the same way. You have to do certain things. You have to have a track record, a proven track record. And sometimes it's really based on what the emphasis is in that community. For instance, with the specialty courts, Chief Anderson is very supportive of the specialty courts, so much so that we run about close to a $400,000 deficit each year just to have specialty courts, because that's an important program to him in our office in a lot of ways. So the idea that we're only trying to just catch people doing wrong things and that we're not really there to help people. I mean, the reality is we're bending over backwards to, you know, kind of put people in a position where they can do better for themselves, do better for their families, you know, and just be more contributing to the society.
Well, a big part of that funding allocation, as you mentioned, is based on performance. And there's a lot of factors that the state, CJAD, looks at as it relates to how a particular county is doing. Bexar County has done really well.
Yes.
In comparison to other counties. I mean, I've seen statistics that really laud the work that Bexar County has done as a result of the work in probation.
Right. And it's because we're very much forward thinking. I think we've been forced to be that way in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Having spent a good bit of time in the federal courts also, you're basically dealing with the same clientele. Right. But in the federal system, they do a lot of research, spend lots of money on research, but don't always follow it, because they've got the resources in a lot of ways that when you've got prison beds, they use prison beds. We got forced in the state of Texas. We had too many people in prison. And it's, you know, you would hope it would be because we want to do it for the right things. But I think it got to a point we just couldn't afford to keep having. So we got forced to become more creative in how we deal with these things. And we figured out that things like specialty courts were, you know, it's really a small part of that population. But at the same time, it's high need resources. And you put your monies into the resources when you have people that are getting arrested over and over. It's amazing the changes you can see, because most of the felony specialty courts, these are, you know, 18-month to 2-year programs. Mm-hmm. And a lot of time, a lot of energy goes into it. But there are statistics that show for every dollar spent in a specialty court, you're going to get $4 in return. Even if you don't care about helping people out and you just want to spend the least amount of money you can, well, specialty courts is one of those ways to do it. Otherwise, you're going to have people sitting in prison. And it's not only that those individuals do better, but their families do much, much better.
Which in the long run helps keep the community safe.
Oh, yes.
So when you say a $4 return for every dollar spent, what goes into that calculation? Like, what is the $4 return that you're getting back?
Oh, it's a whole list of different things, but not having people in prison. not having them in jail. Health outcomes are better. Public services, that being on welfare, all kinds of things that goes into it. You just have people become more responsible and more self-sufficient in a lot of ways.
They're working, they're paying taxes, supporting exactly. their family. That type of thing.
Yes.
You mentioned Chief Anderson a moment ago, and what you're talking about is Chief Jarvis Anderson, who is chief of the probation department here in Bexar County. Now, the judges actually select who the chief probation officer is, but the judges beyond that have no control over how probation officers work or what goes on within the department.
Correct.
How does that work?
It doesn't seem to make sense at first, but it's a necessary separation. Uh-huh. I mean, there's things that if you have the trust that these are the professionals, and I mean, the judges do their part. It's a separation of all everyone's kind of duties. Mm-hmm. And the judges certainly have influence over what happens in, you know, the tone that things take. But to make, you know, the professional decisions, a lot of times, I mean, you really have to have a director, administrator that's very well versed in, you know, the criminal justice system.
That's a massive task.
Yes.
So what does an average day look like for somebody who is working as a probation officer?
We tend to think all probation officers are created equal, that they do the same things.
Right.
And it's really not that way. You've got some probation officers that are in court. That's all they do. They're court liaison officers. So they help facilitate in court. We've got regular supervision officers that just have like a regular caseload, and they'll see, based on an assessment that's done, how often that someone needs, what is their risk, what is their needs at that time. You've got field unit officers that go out, and they're seeing people out in the field constantly. We've got sex offender officers. So, and then in the specialty courts, I mean, when I first started as a probation officer years and years ago, you did everything. You know, you went to court, I wrote PSIs, you know, did everything.
And a PSI is a pre-sentence investigation report.
Yes, yes.
Kind of talk about somebody's history before they get sentenced.
Correct. We would go out in the field, we would do all these things. But as things grew and became more specialized, so did the kind of the duties of an officer. So it back in the days before, you would work for just one court.
I remember those days.
Yes, yes. That was much different. There was things about it. It was easier to be a probation officer. But I think in a lot of ways, we're more effective now the way we were set up. And it's become such a complex job.
Right.
That to do it well, you really have to focus. But especially when you've got large caseloads like we've got, it takes a lot of time. We have all of these monitoring reports. There's lots of people doing UAs, doing the breath checks, the DWI cases, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And that takes a lot of time and effort to figure out, you know, all these reports and that kind of stuff. So if you're doing all your time on just that, you're not doing some of the other things that you have to do. But that's kind of one of the differences in the specialty court officers, because they supervise their cases, they go to court on their cases, they do the field work on their cases, they're doing the staffings, they're working with treatment providers. So they're more like the original probation officer where you're doing, but they've got much smaller caseloads.
So a specialty court officer is more focused on trying to figure out what the underlying issues are of each person that they're dealing with.
Right. And what makes them different is the court is a treatment court,
uh-huh,
as opposed to a regular docket. Most of the time, the probationers, participants, the only time they see the judge is maybe when they get granted probation or when they get revoked from probation. Where in the specialty courts, it's much more intensive supervision. You go through different phases, but for instance, in the felony drug court, they're going to go to court every week. They're going to go to treatment every week or a couple of times a week. They're going to be calling the UA line every day. We'll have like 16, 20 contacts a month with them. They go into court every week. They get to know the judge really well. The judges get to know them well. The judge finds out about their family, is much more involved in it. And so you're trying to deal with some of those barriers that are in the way that keep people from kind of succeeding. One of the things that I've noticed over the years is one of the biggest barriers people just moving on is traffic tickets, that they'll have these insurmountable amount of traffic tickets that they have to pay, and they can't go to treatment. They can't do all these other things they have to do. So we work with them or find ways to help them get over those barriers, things like childcare, GEDs, all those kind of things. So you've got, in a specialty court, you've got a team of probably 20 different people. You've got the judge, you've got the prosecutor, the defense attorneys, the treatment providers. There's a case manager. Case manager's job is to help them get those barriers out of the way, like the GED we talked about, the housing, those kind of things. They have a docket every week, but before the docket, there's a staffing. And the team, the treatment team, to include all those people I just talked about, will sit down and go every single case and say, okay, this is what went right this week, and this is what went wrong this week. This is the things that we need to work on. And it's a different approach on every single person, depending on where they are in the program. If you have somebody come into felony drug court and they've been actively using drugs for a long time, it's not realistic to think, okay, they're just going to stop like that. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not going to be held accountable for it,
right,
but the consequences of it are different at the beginning of the program and at the end of the program. So one of the things that they come into the program, and then the first phase, the biggest thing, the expectation is that, one, you'll show up, and two, that you be honest. You know, the positive drug use, that kind of stuff, we'll address it. There will definitely be consequences to it, but doesn't mean you're going to get kicked out of the program the very first time something goes wrong like that.
Yeah, trying to figure out what other kind of life pressures are involved that sort of leads them in that direction, right?
Right. Right.
What you're describing to me deals with a lot of conditions that folks have to go through. And I've heard the argument sometimes that in specialty courts, or generally speaking in probation, that there are so many conditions are so extensive that it's almost impossible for people to be able to complete them.
Right.
What would your response be to that?
I don't say it appears impossible, but like in the specialty courts, we're asking them to show up all the time. We ask them to do all these things. They go, well, how can I have a life? How can I work? How can I can do all these things if I have to show up all the court and all that kind of thing? Well, that's the part of the badness to it, is to make them change their lifestyle.
Right.
And if they have to always go to court, if they have to always call through the UA line, all these things, then they manage to start doing those things. And at some point, get rid of all the things in their lives that are kind of detrimental to them.
So this has to be a very important part of their lives that Yes. They incorporate.
Right. So it's very, very demanding. So much so that you wonder why do people even go into these programs? One of the pressures I get a lot of times are that, how come you don't have more people in the program? How come you need to go out and get more people? Well, that doesn't work that way. I don't really have a say. So we do the assessments, but we're not dictating. And it's not even really the court. The judge has some control, but not total control. And it's not the prosecutor. Really, what it is a lot of times is the defense attorneys.
Uh-huh.
Because they're the ones that are going to tell their, you know, counsel their clients, yeah, you're going to ask you to do so much, you might as well just do your time. That kind of thing.
And I'm always amazed at those that say, I want to do that program. I want to make a change in my life. I'm ready to deal with whatever these issues are. It really is a good thing to see in the courtroom.
Right.
And so I take it those are the kind of folks that you tend to come across and work with.
Yes.
In the specialty.
Although that way it almost seems like, oh, they're happy to be there. With nothing could be further to, they come in mad. They feel like the probation officer, all he wants is money, you know. And the funny thing is they come in and they get in your face and they cuss at you. And they, it's, you know, it takes a lot of self-control sometimes on the probation officer's part not to react to this kind of stuff. But it comes off very adversarial. And then 2 years later, they're finishing up the program and they're naming their kids after you. And, you know, that kind of thing. But it is that much of a change in lifestyle, a clearing of the mind so much that they can stop blaming everybody else and start taking some responsibility for what's happening to them.
Right. That's a very common feature of folks that are on probation, right?
Yes.
Or folks that get arrested. And obviously not everybody, but, you know,
right.
that is something that we see quite a bit. So some of the things that you bring up, as a probation officer, you've worked in both federal and state for a very significant period of time. Have you ever felt like your life is in danger? Have you ever felt in fear when you come across an individual who is now a probationer?
I've dealt with some pretty dangerous people in one sense. But the reality is, no, I haven't really. You have to be smart about what you do. You don't put yourself in a position to, you know where you are. But the biggest thing I would have to say is I always felt like I wanted people to know that I was there to help them out and not to send them back to prison. It's not uncommon that someone does get revoked, and at the time of their sentencing, they thank the probation officer for helping them out. Now, that's sometimes it's the opposite of that, but you know, it doesn't always go perfect. Sometimes when I've been asked before, well, what is success in the especially courts?
Especially? Yeah, that's a good question.
What do you consider to be success? And I've always thought that 2 years later, they're alive. There are some of these people that there is just no way they would ever get through regular supervision. It's like, why is everybody kidding themselves? There's no way they're going to be able to just make it through. They're going to end up in prison anyway, or did. So it's that balancing act of, yes, we're very, very concerned about public safety. There has to be a certain punitive element to it. But at the same time, we're trying to make people's lives better.
It's like everything within the criminal justice system, yeah. Right? Everything is a balance.
But, I mean, it seems the education of the courts is growing all the time. Right. I mean, and in a lot of ways, we're forced to do these things. 20 years ago, the number of beds that are in Bexar County Jail, right. It's pretty much the same.
It's the same. Yes. Yes. Let's go ahead and break for a Q&A. We'll be right back.
This is Q&A with Judge Ron Rangel. Submit your question today at beyondthegavelpodcast.com.
All right, here's a question. What is deferred adjudication? Is that new? This is a timely question in this particular conversation.
Well, a lot of people, when they either pled guilty or found guilty, there's an option. It's not necessarily their option, but there is an option that they can get deferred adjudication where they're not actually found guilty of it, of the crime. But if they can complete their supervision, then there is not a finding of guilt. Now, that's very positive, unless you don't complete your supervision, then you have a bigger range of penalties that are before them.
The word defer means to put something off. To adjudicate means to close something or maybe find somebody guilty or place them on supervision. So deferred adjudication means you're putting off a finding of guilt. The benefit to that, if you successfully complete it, then the case is dismissed by operation of law. Now, some folks think that that comes off your record. That never actually comes off your record. It will always be there, but you don't have a conviction for certain purposes. For instance, when we bring in people to serve on a jury, part of the requirements that they must meet to be able to be on a jury is they cannot have a conviction for a felony or for a misdemeanor theft. So if you successfully complete a deferred, that means you don't have a conviction for those purposes. The negative part of deferred adjudication is if you do not successfully complete your supervision, because that case was never finalized or closed, then you're looking at the entire range of punishment. So for a first-degree felony, if you're on deferred adjudication, the range of punishment is anywhere from 5 years to 99 years or life if you violate it. Whereas if you had a conviction and had an underlying sentence and then subsequently had that probated for a certain period of time, the maximum period of time that you can do in prison would be the underlying sentence, which can be no more than 10 years if you're going to get community supervision. So the risk is if you're not successful in your deferred adjudication, the potential punishment could be much, much more than what it would be if you have regular supervision. That's a great question. Thank you for asking that. You know, we enjoy answering these questions on Beyond the Gavel. Keep on submitting them. We'll be right back.
This is Q&A with Judge Ron Rangel. Submit your question today at beyondthegavelpodcast.com.
Welcome back. We're talking to Abiel Huggins. You talk about success for people that are on probation and what that means. What are the attributes that would help someone become successful on probation?
Well, I think for a probation officer, you can't be reactionary. Mm-hmm. You have to step back and think in your mind, you know, what is the best for this person? It's not a lot of times we want to drag them to where we want them to be, but a lot of times you got to meet them first where they're at. It's called motivational interviewing.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're not just telling people, but you're trying to get information from them. And it's a real skill. You have to sit there and be non-judgmental of what they're telling you, even though sometimes some of the stuff they tell you is just crazy. You want them to come around to knowing the answer themselves. You have to also know what the limits of your skills are. I remember one time that one of the officers that worked for me said, "Hey, Mr. So-and-so is here again, and he's obviously intoxicated. Will you talk to him?" So Mr. So-and-so comes into my office, and I'm talking to him, and I said, "Hey, your officer thinks you've been drinking." And he tells me, "No, there's no way I would do that. I would never do that to my daughter." And I'm, okay, I'm not going to overreact. You're obviously, you know, drinking. So I just sit there for a second and I go, "Well, so it sounds like your daughter's really important." He stands up. He takes his leg off. He's got a prosthesis. He's about to whack me over, tell me, "Keep my daughter out of this." So I realize motivational interview doesn't work in all instances. So you have to have a full tool belt of skills to do things. So, you know, when people come on supervision, I've said a couple times, you put your resources into the people that need it. If you treat people that don't need treating, you're making them worse. You want to over-supervise people, but at the same time, you don't want to under-supervise people either.
In order to give the listeners to be on the gavel a full sense of what probation officers do, I got to speak to a lot of different people because it is so diverse in terms of the type of work that each officer does.
Oh, very much so.
We started the Felony Mental Health Pretrial Diversion Court, which does not include probation officers from the probation department, because they are not on probation yet.
Correct.
Right? Those cases are pending. And if they successfully complete their supervision in the pretrial diversion court, then the case is ultimately dismissed. What would be the differences as a probation officer that you would see would relate to somebody in a pretrial diversion program versus a post-conviction program?
Ultimately, what is the incentive?
Yeah.
And really, because it amazes me sometimes why people agree to be in our programs.
Yeah.
Because it is so much demanding of them, not only time-wise, there's usually an additional $1,000 fee that they have to pay. If they could get off of probation, if they would just do their jail time, they would be off right away. But it's a lot of times people, their lives are so far gone, or they just want something to make life better in some ways. Really, to answer your question is how, what can we do to incentivize people to do what's right for themselves?
You were talking to me earlier about addiction, and addiction seems to be a big part of folks that are involved in the justice system.
Very much so.
How do you think those types of issues affect treatment in specialty courts?
You know, one of the things that what happens with, especially with addiction, is that their lives are out of control. No matter what they do, I mean, how much it tears down their lives, they still keep doing it over and over and over again. Basically, it's because they don't have the skills to do it by themselves. Uh-huh. As an example, the veterans courts. One of the really effective things is if you only have veterans in the program, there is a point where it gives them a point of reference to a time when they were proud of what they did. The fact that they can be around other veterans and they have a community and then they can share it with people that have like experiences can be very, very powerful. Right. But you have to have somebody that does have a like experience in a lot of ways.
I've read that it takes at least a year for the brain to heal and rid itself of things like alcohol addiction, certain type of drug addictions. Is that accurate?
Oh, yes. At least. It takes a long time to recover from that stuff. That's part of the balancing act, is to figure out what people need in terms of, is this more of a behavioral issue or is this more of a treatment issue?
That type of healing does not consider the fact that certain parts of the brain chemistry is forever altered. You're dealing with some real hardcore situation. The best that you can do is sometimes to get somebody to understand what they're doing and to help keep them alive.
It's not hopeless either.
So let's say we go back 36 years. I'm speaking to Abel Huggins, a young, soon-to-be probation officer. looking forward, what would be the thing that would have surprised you the most that you've learned about job and the things that you do as a probation officer?
It's so much more complex than I ever thought it was. It's the things I remember when I was a brand new officer, and one day this lady came in my office, and I was reading her the conditions of supervision. I didn't know the top from the bottom. I didn't know what I was doing at all. I tell her, "Oh, I'm sorry, and she goes, "Oh no, let me show you." She was showing me. She was on probation. She'd been on probation several times before, and she was showing me how to do things. Thing is, be open to where you learn. Just because I had a degree, I didn't really have an experience. There was people I looked up for a good reason, some of them not a good reason, but always be open to learning new things and understanding that people can change.
It's never as black and white as people try to make the system out to be, right? There's always more to it than just...
I remember there was a woman that was in the Esperanza court. She was trouble. I mean, she was just, I knew she was going to give us a hard time. And sure enough, she did. Uh-huh. Slowly over time, she really kind of bought into the program and changed the way we were thinking. And I remember she was all excited one Friday. I said, "Well, what are you all excited about?" She had four kids between the ages of 16 and 2. And I said, "Well, what's going on?" She says, "Well, my four kids are going to get to meet." I go, "What do you mean your four kids are going to get to meet?" Yeah. She says, "They've never met. Every time I had a child, my child was taken away from me." And I thought, oh my gosh, that's just her living experience is so much different than I have. And, sometimes you have to put yourself in their place, but, at the same time, you have to always realize, hey, I've got something to contribute to their lives also, and vice versa.
What are some of the most rewarding experiences that you've had?
In the felony drug court, there was a woman that was in the program, had a pretty hard time of it. Uh-huh. But again, she stuck with it. Often she brought her kids with her, or they were exposed to what was happening in the court and the program, and they've got a sense of it also.
What were their ages?
Fairly young to, teenagers and that kind of stuff. Yeah. So that one of the daughters, especially, was very much paying attention to what was going on and saw that her mom was changing, and it took a lot of the chaos out of her life to the point that she ended up getting a scholarship going to A&M. Then after graduating from A&M, she decided she was going to go to law school. As the speaker at one of the graduations, they asked her to be a speaker. The Judge Glenn was asking her, "Hey, well, what is it you want to do with your law degree? What is it that you think you could do?" And she goes, "Well, you want me to be honest?" And he goes, "Yes." She goes, "I want your job. I want to be the drug court judge." Yeah. And that's when I really felt, oh man, this stuff really works. It makes a difference.
I read somewhere that something like there's a 90% chance of someone who grew up with one parent in custody for at least 1 year will never get out of the poverty level. Those kind of statistics are scary.
Yes.
When you consider some of the things that we're having to face. You seem to me to be pretty affable. You smile a lot. You got a great reputation. Everybody thinks highly of you. I think we're fortunate to have you here. What do you do to keep yourself in a positive mindset dealing with as many individuals as you do? How do you relax?
Well, I've been married 40 years.
Uh-huh. That's the secret.
I've got three kids. I've got two grandkids. I've got a close relationship with my family.
Stable.
That's exactly. My parents lived in the same house for 60 years. I've had a lot of stability in my life, and I guess that's why I'm pretty empathetic to the people that are in these programs, because what they lived through and what I've lived through are two different things. But that doesn't mean that we can't find somewhere to meet to kind of come to that's beneficial both ways. I just appreciate all the things I've had in my life and that I see the other things that people don't. It's like I've pretty much worked on the downtown West Side my whole career in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And you think people, there's a stereotype of the West Side. I just think there's a lot of great people. As an example, I had this guy come into the office and he said, "Hey, am I going to get in trouble with probation if I break my lease?" And I go, "Well, no, that's more of a civil matter. But, why do you want to break your lease?" He goes, "Oh, where I'm living right now is really, really dangerous. There's drugs everywhere, people, bad stuff going on." I go, "Okay, well, where do you want to go? And he goes, "Well, I grew up on the West Side. I want to move back there. I know the neighborhood and I'll do fine." I said, "Okay, well, where are you? where are you living right now? He goes, off, you know, Stone Oak and Evans right out there. There's a lot of drugs out there. Oh. All, so, you know, just because you live in one place, there's a lot of different experiences, but there's a lot of similar experiences also.
Yeah. So you've been blessed. We've been blessed to be raised with good parents.
Yes.
And of course, you have empathy.
Yeah.
You understand the human condition and what folks go through. We did a Q&A a couple weeks ago. One of the questions made reference to probation being an example of somebody getting off easy with a slap on the wrist.
Yeah. Getting off easy, it's got to be portional. And what is the purpose of probation? What is the purpose of the courts? We tend to think that we can solve everything one way and that everyone that commits a crime should go to prison. It's just not an efficient, maybe it feels good for a short period of time is for the community, but the community would feel a lot better if they didn't have to deal with so much crime also.
What are the typical standard conditions of probation that people have to sign on when they get probation, just in a regular court first, and then what additional conditions does somebody have in specialty courts?
It's really comes down to you have a lot of accountability. You have to accountability through you're getting drug tested all the time, that you have to tell us where you're living. We have to know, you know, it's very intrusive into their lives in a lot of ways. It's not getting off a slap on the wrist. It's they get mad and it's not like we get any pleasure having to be so intrusive in their lives. And it's a lot of tension, but it's coming to figuring out that, hey, these are things you have to do to make things change in your lives. There's monies they have to pay. It's a lot of pressure on people in a lot of ways.
They can't hang out with certain people. They got to maintain employment.
Right. And they have to tell us about it. You know, we have to know every little thing about their lives to a point, mm-hmm. you know. And the thing that happens, though, is that they build a certain level of trust and it's earned over time. It's something earned over and over by complying in a lot of ways.
Right. They give up the ability to have privacy in their home. That's something that a lot of folks don't understand.
Right. At the same time, we can't be intrusive as a probation officer unless there's a reason to be intrusive. It's just, I'm not like that first probation officer I mentioned that, well, I'm your daddy now. Well, right. That's, you can't do that. That's not effective.
As you mentioned, it's got to be proportional.
Right.
So we're talking about how successful specialty court programs can be. How do you compare the percentages of folks that get into programs and complete them successfully versus somebody who's on regular supervision?
When people come into our programs, they're there for a reason. Their behavior has been so atrocious up to that point that they qualify for the program. Mm-hmm. Like I said earlier, you can't just be ordered into the program. You have to be assessed for the program.
Right.
And if you meet the criteria, and so typically what we accept about 40% of the people that apply for the specialty courts. Mm-hmm. In the felony drug court, it's an 18 to 24 month program, but they've got a completion rate of 80 to 85%.
Wow.
To me, that's one of the really, really impressive things is a lot more effort to just stay with them and continue to work with them and be of that mindset that, yeah, they're screwing up, but they can do better. I read articles all the time saying, oh, that specialty courts don't work, you know, that you're letting them off easy. But when you really start listening to some of the things that they're saying, reasons why, it's because there's like 10 key components that make a good specialty court.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not following all those components, then you're really not a specialty court.
Correct.
And your results are not going to be what they are in Bexar County. Luckily, we have we're known throughout the country how strong our programs are. And we have, I mean, our programs have been around for a long, long time. Where other places, they're cutting programs and we're adding programs.
Right.
Because we follow those key components, and that really makes a huge difference.
Which is a combination of all the parts of the system, right?
Yes.
In Bexar County. I read that the first specialty court that was recognized was in California in the 1970s. And here we are, 2023, and Bexar County is one of the top dogs
yeah.
in the country as it relates to forward thinking and the justice system and the things that we've done, not just in specialty courts, but how we've handled probation and how we've handled other things related to indigent defense and some other issues. How would you attribute Bexar County being so well recognized in these areas of all the other places that could exist?
We've had people, judges that have stepped up and kind of done the hard work in a lot of ways. Okay. Judge Alonzo, he was one of the first ones to kind of start pushing this idea. Uh-huh. He always tells the story that when he wanted to start the first specialty court, he couldn't get any probation officers to volunteer to be in that program because they thought, oh, this is a bunch of hooey, you know, that, yeah. that you're just this hug-a-thug kind of stuff. What's really, really, I think, helped is just the amount of teaching that's gone and that we had some success. We've always been very flexible. The idea of using jail as a sanction. It used to be people would mess up and, okay, just go sit in jail for 2 months. We finally started realizing that's doing much more harm than good. Not that you can't use jail as a sanction, but after about 3 days, you're losing any effectiveness right. it's going to be. You're becoming more disruptive in their lives than changing their behavior. And that's the thing is, I think the judges that have over time that have participated in the specialty courts have been willing to, you know, take a different eye to things, see things in a different way, willing to learn the new ways. It amazes me not only that participants are willing to participate, that the judges are also, because like, you know, it's a lot of work. I mean, if you've got a full-time docket, and then you're going to do especially court on the side. You think, oh, well, it's just one day. No, it's not mm-hmm. one day. You maybe only have court one day, but it's throughout the week, 7 day a week.
It's a lot of work. And sometimes it could backfire on a judge, right? Judges open themselves up to criticism for embracing specialty court concepts, especially when crime rates seem to be reported more. They seem to be going up in certain segments of how we define crime. There's yes. always a risk. But I think the most important thing about what we're doing in the courthouse is we believe what we're doing to make society better. All right. So you've been around 36 years. That's a long time. I don't assume that you'll be around forever. You got any plans in the future regarding your career?
I'm going to be doing a lot of traveling. One of the things that my wife and I would like to do, and we've talked about, it's become our new obsession. We're watching YouTube videos all the time. We're reading reviews of this kind of equipment, that kind. We want to do the Camino Santiago, or the hike from the Pyrenees in France all the way down to Santiago, Spain.
Nice.
And we're kind of fired up for that. So that's about as far away from criminal justice. So I'm very proud of what I've done over the time. Uh-huh. But at the same time, you know, it takes a toll on it. It's just, you see people going through all these trials and tribulations, and you have to detach yourself. But there's a little bit of you always kind of goes with it also.
Right.
I just need a rest in my brain in some ways and all.
So now you're telling me you're retiring.
I am retiring uh-huh. end of August.
So okay.
This coming month. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we will miss you.
Yeah. Well, I'm proud of what I've done, and I'm proud of how I've been supported through it also. So.
Emil, I've enjoyed this conversation.
Thanks. It's been great being here.
You brought a wealth of knowledge into this. And frankly, there's a lot that we could talk about with you as it relates to being a probation officer. Is there any last thing that you would like the listeners to know about you?
That, you know, I think that most probation officers feel that they're doing something worthwhile. And I want to promote people to think about, you know, working in the criminal justice system.
I work with a lot of probation officers, obviously, in my field. And I can say that by and large, it is a wonderful group of individuals that truly care about doing their part to help our community thrive. And I feel very fortunate to have these individuals work on the front lines of our system. Thank you very much for coming on. You've reached the end of this episode. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
You've been listening to Beyond the Gavel with Judge Ron Rangel. Join us in the next 2 weeks where we are educating the public and expanding mindsets. Head to our website, beyondthegavelpodcast.com, or your favorite podcast platform to subscribe to the latest episodes and updates.